Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economic show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show. Welcome, 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 welcome to the 248th edition of Money Matters, Money Matters, entitled Worker Bees or Busybodies. Don't know why I picked that title. Hopefully it'll be applicable today. We'll cover all sorts of neat stuff about the markets and all sorts of questions that I've been being asked over the last couple of weeks. But before we begin, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only, and the opinions of any authors of any articles or anything else I may read. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. And now, for the next edition, keep in mind that Money Matters is about money. As money does matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another, whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it. It controls our economy, our country, our planet, in some way or another, controls the very way we, you, I, live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, it's about you. Yes, I had a Diet Coke before I came in here, so the phenylalanine is running all over my body. Hit the gym, so brain's moving. I don't know about the rest of me, but the brain is moving. And welcome. Yeah, my name's Mark Cuniberti with an M-A-R-C. But you know, it's funny. I was born M-A-R-K. And in a attempt to grab individuality, I changed it to an M-A-R-C myself. Which was kind of like a teenage thing to do. And the reason I did it is because I saw a guy named Mark Schaefer, M-A-R-C, if my memory serves me correct, as a credit on a Star Trek. So I changed it to M-A-R-C. Now, here's the problem, okay? My driver's license says M-A-R-C, but everything else from the IRS and my passport says M-A-R-K. So the DMV believes I'm M-A-R-C, which leads me to believe that a person could actually change their name one letter at a time. And slowly over time, you could change your complete name. And the only people that would still have the original name would be the IRS. Of course, that would be the most important people to have your real name. So, on some of my licenses, it's always M-A-R-K, and some of my signatures are M-A-R-C, and people ask me and say, hey, Ascona. So now I have to list it on unofficial forms. Do you go by any nicknames? And I have to say M-A-R-C is a nickname. Otherwise, they get all squirrely. And it's funny, you know, when I fly, it may say M-A-R-K on my passport, and my driver's license say M-A-R-C. So far, nobody has said, you're not the same dude, right? So, anyway, I do believe, you know, I always wanted to change my name, the last name, legally to Void, V-O-I-D. So every time I signed a check, I could just sign Void. And I think I did look up, see if anybody had the last name of Void. Don't remember the results of that search. So, good afternoon. Today is what? March 16th. Oh, March 16th, 2017, in the year of our Lord. 12:12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You may not be listening to the show at that exact minute because we have a 3-second delay. but also because the show is pre-recorded for other stations. It's live now if you're on it March 16th, 12 p.m. But other stations pick it up and re-air it. So if you're hearing this at a later date, welcome. Welcome. I did it yesterday, and I wonder what I'm doing while you're listening to it. Right? A little too deep. I understand. So we look at the Dow, and again, we talk about resistance and support points, large numbers, such as 20,000 on the Dow, 19,000 is another large number, 21,000 is another large number. Now, we did, I think when Trump was, the numbers came out, he was going to win, the Dow was sitting around 17,000 and some change, and since he's been ordained, we went over 21,000, and now we're at 20,916. So 21,000 would now, since we're under 21,000, 21,000 would be a resistance point. Now Dow's going to have to fight to punch through that. And right now at 20,916, the 20,000 level would be support. So to fall below 20,000, we'd have to try to punch through that. So these are technical support and resistance levels. So if we're above a large number, the number below us is a support level. If we're below a large number, the number above us is a resistance level. So at 20,916, if we were to look at the very largest numbers, which are the 10,000 multiples, then 21,000 right now is a resistance point and 20,000 is a support point. So just kind of, you know. Snapchat came out. I did not participate in Snapchat. That's not a recommendation or not a not recommendation for Snapchat. It's just, I've used some of those IPOs. I think everybody would agree they can be a little volatile. And volatile means risk. And risk means conservative investors try to avoid risk, or at least a good part of it. So, there you go. I had a couple of clients ask about Snapchat. So I gave my opinions to them, but I'm not going to give you my opinion over the air. Compliance departments don't like me to do that. So I can just say that anything that's very volatile goes hand in hand with more risk. If you're more volatile, generally considered as more risk. So, you know, you draw your own conclusions there. But it is interesting, you know, the Fed came out and a couple days ago, I think it was Wednesday, yesterday, they raised interest rates by 0.25%. Wow. So the overnight rate's between 7.75% and 1% now. And Dow loved it. I mean, yesterday was one of the rare times where I saw everything in at least our portfolios green yesterday. That's rare. You know, like, I think the only other time, which my memory drums up, that I've seen everything in a one color is, I think it was August 2009 or September, I saw a complete red board. And I think it was 08 or 09, I can't quite remember now. And I called a buddy of mine and I said, are you seeing what I'm seeing? Because normally you see greens and reds. When it's somebody's buying something, they're selling something else. So, you know, you see greens and reds. To see an all one color board is rare for me. I don't see it on the stuff that I look at. And I look at a lot of stuff, man. And 2008, I saw a complete red board, and except for the things that are designed to go up when the market goes down, I hold a few of those, what I call hedges, you know, like a teeter-totter. Something goes down, other things go up. But everything that was supposed to go up was red. Everything. Everything. And I called a buddy of mine, and I said, are you seeing what I'm looking at? And he says, what are you looking at? I said, I'm not looking at a complete red board except for these alternative strategies. And he said, yeah, it's a worldwide fire sale. And that's basically what we saw in 2008, 2009. Normally, bonds and stocks move opposite of each other. That really hasn't been the case since 08. You know, they can, but you know, in 08 or whenever it was that I saw it, they were everything I saw was red. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was basically a liquidity problem, bleeding into a solvency problem. And that's important that you understand the difference between liquidity and solvency. The words are similar, but the meaning is not. And I've always used the analogy. Suppose I owe $20 to somebody. And that person that I owe the money to comes forward and says, pay me. And so I say, well, I have $20 at home, but I don't have it on me. That is a liquidity problem. I have the money, but I don't have the money on me. Liquidity. In example number two is when somebody comes to me and says, you owe me $20. And I said, well, I don't have the money on me, and I don't have the money at home either. That's a solvency problem. See what I mean? See the difference? Liquidity and solvency. So what we had in 08 and 09 was a severe solvency problem. Severe. And that led to a liquidity problem. When I'm insolvent, I also don't have any cash. If I don't have any cash at home, I don't have any cash on me. So it was a solvency problem. The Fed looked at it like a liquidity problem. They said, well, we need more liquidity, which meant cash. And although many, many institutions were insolvent, the Fed addressed it like a liquidity problem and supplied the companies that were insolvent with free cash. So they basically went home and filled the coffers of these insolvent companies with liquidity. And therefore, this solvency problem was, I don't know, if you loan somebody who's insolvent money, is he still insolvent? No, not really. But looking at it from a basic level, if I'm insolvent, I don't have any money anywhere, and you loan me money, you have basically addressed my liquidity symptom. But I still owe the money. So I'm still insolvent, but you've given me the money to act like I'm solvent because I have liquidity. You see what I'm saying there? Kind of an interesting concept. There's everybody out there is real smart that listens to the show, and you know, 99% of the people are real smart anyway. And so this important concept is that we had an insolvency problem with many, many institutions, and the Fed addressed it as a liquidity problem by providing more liquidity. Now, if it was free money to these insolvent corporations, then they become solvent. But if it's a loan, then they're still insolvent, but they appear to have money because they do on a loan. So it's kind of an important concept. Now, the question is, the money that they loaned to these insolvent companies, did these insolvent companies, were they given money? Well, the ones that were given money were made solvent again by the Fed. And as in the process of being solvent, the liquidity symptom went away because they got cash. But for those companies that got loans, they're still basically insolvent, but they had their liquidity symptom of the insolvency addressed. So what the Fed did is they said, well, if we loan money to these institutions, it doesn't solve their insolvency problem because they'll still owe us the money. So through a variety of programs, and I mean a wide variety and a large quantity of programs, they provided liquidity and also partially addressed some of their insolvency by just having so many programs. It was basically like, well, we'll loan you money, but you don't have to pay it back. Oh, we'll loan you money, but if you lose money on this, you don't have to pay it back. So there, you know, the whole crisis of 08 and 09 was an amazing study of what a Federal Reserve or a central bank can do to address a massive crisis. And I'm telling you, that 08-09 crisis was some scary. I mean, it really was, you know, from an observer's point of view, me and many like me that look at this stuff a lot, it was a once-in-a-lifetime chance to see what happens. And the lesson of what happens is not over by any stretch of the means, because the debt that was amassed to solve the insolvency problem has just been transferred to the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. So you could say, well, they solved the solvency problem by giving money to certain corporations and loaning money under favorable terms to certain corporations. But that debt did not go away. Those loans now are carried at the Federal Reserve. So when you hear the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, just think of it as a garbage dump. Okay? The Federal Reserve's balance sheet is extremely large, and you think, oh, they got a lot of money. No. Think of the large balance sheet as a large warehouse full of debt, because that's what it is. When they say the federal balance sheet is very large and growing, that's just, they're accumulating and holding more debt. So it's kind of an interesting observation when we look at, did they solve the problem? Well, they did, in a way. They solved it liquidity-wise, and they solved the insolvency problem by just taking on the debt of a lot of major institutions. And the Fed still has the debt. And if you need to verify that, just go on to Google and Google up Federal Reserve balance sheet. And just think of that as garbage dump. And then you'll see that through the last 100 years, Fed was established in 1913, so it's 2017, so it's 204 years. If you look at a chart of the Federal Reserve balance sheet, it looks fairly flat up until 08, and then it takes off like Mount Everest, like the old Al Gore greenhouse gas chart, where he got up on a ladder to show you the spike of the greenhouse gases. It's the Federal Reserve balance sheet looks much like that. And so when you hear people like me that will say, you know, we have a lot of debt in the world and the central banks have a lot of it, you don't have to believe us. And it's fairly easy to see, is just go to the Federal Reserve balance sheet and you'll see flat, flat, flat to the last 7 years, and then wham, straight up. If you want to see the government debt, remember, the Federal Reserve is different than the U.S. government, okay? It's a quasi-governmental institution, but there's two debts you can look at. You look at the Federal Reserve balance sheet. Think of that as a garbage dump. Think of it as how much debt have they taken off of private institutions. So there's a lot of debt there. If you look at what the government owes, is totally different. And you, if you go to debtclock.org, I think it's usdebtclock.org. Anyway, just Google up US debt clock. And you'll get this screen that shows a bunch of numbers that are constantly climbing. They have some numbers that are going negative, but they're constantly climbing. And one of the things going negative is the amount of debt. I think they show it as a positive number. And you'll be amazed at how fast these little digits are clicking off. I mean, they just click off like crazy. So it is interesting. Go to usdebtclock.org. Check it out yourself. Very interesting thing to see there. It'll scare the you-know-what out of you. And then go to the Federal Reserve balance sheet. We are running up into a debt ceiling. You know, the U.S. government can't just continually run up debt. It has to be authorized to do that. So we have a debt ceiling. So you can't borrow any more than this. Well, they keep raising the debt ceiling to facilitate more borrowing by the U.S. government. But they have to do that every so often. And so it's coming up. You know, it's coming up. I think the last figure I saw yesterday, that the U.S. Treasury has about $30 billion left, and then it's going to be out of money. Now, are they really out of money? No, they can just raise the debt ceiling. So that's coming around. Now, I have been contacted. There were a lot of prognostication newsletters, and some of them pegged yesterday as the end of the world. Okay, then I got a couple of clients that said, you know, this next Wednesday the world's going to end, which was yesterday. And the reason they said that is because they were afraid that Janet Yellen, head of the Federal Reserve Board, would raise rates and crush the markets. Well, she did raise rates, quarter point or so. And yesterday I saw a complete green board. I mean, I saw almost everything go up. I saw equities as a general rule went up. I'm sure there were some stocks that went down, but my board was green. I saw utilities climb yesterday, and mortgage-backed securities climb, and fixed income climb, and I thought everything climb. I don't think I saw one thing red yesterday, in at least the indexes that I look at. And the only thing I saw fall yesterday was what we call the volatility index, and just think of that as being in a ship. And whether the ship is going forward or backward, you can think of the ship going forward as the stock market going up, and the ship going backwards is the stock market going down. But the volatility is how rough the waves are, okay? So the volatility doesn't necessarily indicate where the ship is going up or down or forward and back, but it does indicate how rough it is and how volatile this is. And there's a volatility index. And when the markets go up hard, people don't get worried and the volatility drops. And so the volatility index yesterday was, you know, I saw a lot of red, and the volatility index has been dropping steadily with little bumps and maybe occasional blips up, but it has been dropping steadily. And you can take a look at that at the VIX index, VIX, the volatility index, and it continues to drop. And so you know, you when you see the green board like I saw yesterday, really, I mean, yesterday's observation of my board was rare. It was really rare, and it was interesting because the market ran, I don't know, 139 points or something. It wasn't like a 500-point rally, but it was across the board. And even things that generally move in opposite of each other didn't. They were all correlated. And so it was really strange yesterday. It was interesting, you know. I'm sure everybody liked it who held portfolios, because I'm sure there's hardly anybody's portfolio down yesterday. I don't know, maybe. But on my board, it was all green. It's good to see, but it was kind of an interesting observation. So we'll see what happens. The Dow right now is down 30. You know, it's noise. I really don't see there's anything weird about that. Gold's up $6 today. It was up pretty good yesterday. And so we'll keep an eye on this for you. You know, I always say watching the market so you don't have to. And it's really true. You know, if you keep tuned to the show and the newsletters and the newscasts from myself, you know, the newscasts sometimes shoot off into other tangents. You know, I get a hair at my you-know-what, and then I write about going to Costco or something. But for the most part, you know, the shows will touch on what it is in the newsletters. Now, the newsletter is offered at no charge for listening to your community radio station. No matter what station you're listening to, we like to offer the newsletter for free. And so you just get that. The website for that is moneymanagementradio.com. It's a totally free website. It's no money garnered from anyone on anything, no advertisers, nothing. It's a completely free website. It's not free for me. I got to pay. But you can get the newsletter that way. Or you can contact the director, program director at your station. Have them contact me and we'll put you on there. And I don't spam. I don't sell the email address. You just get emails from me. That's it. And they're all hidden. So you're not going to see emails from the email addresses of somebody else. And somebody else won't see yours. So we're going to talk a little bit more. We'll take a musical break for a second. And then we will be right back. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. And my name's Mark Gunaberti. And stay tuned. Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. welcome back to Money Matters. Now, my next line of commentary is tongue-in-cheek, all right? And so, you know, this is tongue-in-cheek, and so don't take offense to any of this, but it's something that I've observed in my many years of, used to teach sales classes, and consulted on business operations, and I've known a lot of people in working. You know, I'm an old man now, and so I've been in the work industry, you know, since 18 years old, and graduated from college in 1979, and I've been hustling and bustling ever since. And so in my observation of how people work and what kind of people there are out there, I got a wild hair, and I wrote this observation. I also drank a little Diet Pepsi, so they say always be careful when you're on the air because, you know, you could have a burp slip out. I remember I was listening to Chris Berman on Monday Night Football, and he was talking, and right in the middle of a talk, a burp slipped out. Nobody even caught it. I caught it. You know, my ears are real sensitive. Your McCown coming in the background, and I'll play a little music in the background because this is tongue-in-cheek, so don't get offended. You know, it's more funny than it is. It starts like this. This is the type, you know, I've called these people that I have noticed in my life, the way people work, is spinners, earth movers, doers, dawdlers, talkers, slugs, fakers, weasels, and crooks. Now, I can comfortably say that 99.9% of you out there are in the doer category. So when I say spinners, earth movers, doers, dawdlers, talkers, slugs, fakers, weasels, and crooks, what do I mean? These are not animal descriptions. These are my own classifications as they relate to people and how they approach working. Now take it in stride. I am not a psychotherapist. I don't have any degrees in psychotherapy. It's just my observations. So the easiest kind of worker to spot are the earth movers and crooks. Okay, now earth movers, my own name for these people, those are the people that start the incredible companies that revolutionize how we live. Earth movers may or may not be college educated, and many, many attend Ivy League schools only to drop out midway through their education because they know their great ideas don't need degrees to make them work. Most of these people that I'm going to name did drop out of an Ivy League school before getting the degree. Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk. They're all billionaires, and they've changed the way we live our lives through their genius. I mean, their companies are incredible. I'm sure you can name a lot more, but you know the companies that I'm talking about. You know the products they developed that I'm talking about. They have changed the way we live. As a community, earth movers usually operate alone or in pairs, kind of like animals, right? Alone or in pairs. Then there's the crooks. Crooks are very easy to understand and identify. They're basically crooks. They lie, cheat, and steal to make a living, and they are usually a victim of a personality disorder or two. Crooks operate alone, but if you find two of them in cahoots, the con is usually much bigger in scope. Now let's look at the rest. Remember, this is all tongue-in-cheek. Doers, okay? Doers. Doers are good folks. They are pragmatic. When I see a doer, he's pragmatic. They start a lot of businesses that usually succeed. They also make good employees, and they know the value of a buck, right? That's all of us. We work hard. We treat others fairly. We're honest, and we live fruitful lives that contribute to society, and we rarely take handouts. And when we do, we only do so temporarily. Most of you, if not all of you, fit into the doer class. If you're listening to this at work or in your car and you're going to work, you're a doer. Doers operate solo or in groups of any size. Then we go into the dawdlers, talkers, and slugs. Now remember, don't get offended, okay? Dawdlers just don't want to work. They think the world is one big jelly bean field where they can lie around and write poetry all day. None of this conformist working nonsense for the dawdlers. Dawdlers idle away their hours in coffee houses, hiking, or hanging out at the river during the day while everyone else is, you guessed it, working. Then there's the talkers. Talkers also don't like working much. But talkers back up their non-working with verbal diatribes to counter their what I call low self-esteem, which got that way by not working. You know, when you work, you get high self-esteem. When you don't work, you know, your self-esteem can fall. Talkers might make up many of the daytime groups that you see during the day. They're there because they're not working. Talkers can often end up as people that have a lot of opinions, or they work a few hours a week here or there, but they're basically working a few hours a week to convince themselves that their unemployment is necessary so they can let the world know their point of view, right? They always have a point of view. They're not just non-workers, they have a very strong point of view. Like dawdlers, talkers can be on a public dole while complaining about the very system that gives them their checks. Now, that's not to say that everybody on public assistance is a dawdler or a talker. No. Most people on there need the assistance temporarily, and that's fine. But there's a certain class that are just there, and you know, probably know a few of those that are just there, but complain about the very system that gives them their check. Dawdlers and talkers usually can't make it in the private sector where performance is actually expected, so they operate on the fringes of normal society. Both dawdlers and talkers are usually found in large groups. Then there are the slugs. And, you know, you've known a couple of these people. You know, slugs just can't catch a break. I don't know what it is. They're just born under a different star. The slugs, you know, may never hold a job longer than a few months. And they constantly blame others or circumstances out of their control for their plight. When you catch up with a slug, which is easy to do, they always tell you how hard their life is or how bad luck follows them everywhere like the plague, which is usually true. The world is full of dawdlers and talkers, but you won't run into many slugs. God didn't make a lot of them, and that's probably a good thing. Slugs live solo, usually. I've known a few, except for the rare occasion where they find a mate that usually takes care of them. Then there's the fakers. Fakers are interesting. Fakers, like talkers, have outward personalities. I've known a lot of fakers. Fakers attempt to appear like doers, but much of that is illusion, and therein lies the difference. You can tell a faker, they usually have long resumes with many jobs listed, and their spotty work resume shows kind of a nomadic quality to it. You know, I lived in Wisconsin, and I lived in here, and then I lived in there. They move jobs and locations, and sometimes you see these titles attached to their last names. It's a variety of letters that you don't know what it is. It'll say, you know, Bob Schmitz, LS-DWA, and you know, there are designations that you've never heard of, but they trail their signature page. These people may end up, you know, sometimes they end up as consultants of some kind, but you can never figure out what they do. They can move in and out of careers. Sometimes they can study a few months to get an impressive sounding certification. You know, there are jobs where you study a few months and you can get a nice certification. Like financial advisor, really, you know, college degree and study hard to pass a Series 65 test and you're a financial advisor. You know, a financial advisor could be what I call a faker. Or a realtor or something like that, too. It's where you study, and then you get this degree that sounds great. Now, I'm not meaning offense to realtors or financial advisors. I mean, I'm one of them, right? And I don't mean to insult those that are in that field. It's just that fakers are the type that enter your field, and then they leave when the going gets tough, and that mucks up the business for the rest of us, right? It's like, oh, yeah, I knew this financial advisor. He was there, and then he quit. You know, it mucks it up for us realtors and us financial advisors that are working hard in our field. Heaven help the people who follow the advice of fakers. Fakers are usually where they are because they can't hold a real job for any length of time. Fakers usually operate alone, but they can support each other in groups. You know, they can. And then there's weasels. Weasels are also an interesting group, and I've worked for a weasel. And weasels are not crooks. They don't break any laws, usually. Weasels are sort of delusional con artists, but they use legal techniques to borrow or garner money from others, and then they just don't pay it back. The excuse that a weasel uses is that the investment or whatever you put your money in didn't work out, and then your money is now gone. The living expenses of the weasel, however, is usually taken from the investment money you gave them. This is how the weasel survives. Like monetary locusts, they move from sucker to sucker all the while telling a good story. Remember, weasels aren't crooks, usually. They're just kind of delusional that their idea is going to work out, and they believe their own schemes. They just have a history of failed endeavors. And the delusional mind of the weasel never makes the connection that the idea wasn't any good. There's always an excuse. You'll know a weasel because they occasionally find themselves in lawsuits revolving around one or more of their failed endeavors. As for community, weasels usually operate alone, you know. Last but not least come the spinners. And the spinners, I mean, there's a lot of spinners. Spinners come from a wide variety of backgrounds, and they are very common. They can hold a good day job, or maybe they don't hold a good day job. The day job could be the main source of income for a spinner. Or they may spend their internal life on the treadmill of their spinning. Spinners are like cars stuck in a mud. You know, I used to know a friend of mine, dear friend, who used to say, oh, that guy's a spinner. That's the wheels. The wheels turn on a spinner, but they usually don't go anywhere. If a spinner goes somewhere, they usually don't go far. Spinners have these grandiose ideas. They may appear like earth movers, but the ideas really aren't that as genius as an earth mover. Spinners have grandiose ideas, and they go wholeheartedly into each endeavor. Bless their souls. They really believe in what they're doing. The problem is, spinners aren't pragmatic. You know, they usually don't possess the common sense or diligence of the doer. And they really don't have the fortitude to make their projects work like a doer does. Spinners usually have a lot of businesses behind their name. They've worked here and they've worked there and they've worked here and they've worked there, or they've tried this website or they've tried that website. They make a website here, they make a website there. If they work real jobs, they will use their salaries to finance their ideas, okay? And they wholeheartedly believe these ideas. They just don't really have the stick-it-to-itness to see them through. If they have a day job and they're financing their spinning endeavors, they usually never accumulate a lot of wealth because every time they get money, they plow it into the next idea. They can be very close to weasels. But I've worked for a spinner. I work for a weasel. Not meant as derogatory names, at least, you know, I'm just saying that a couple of these people I worked for, they had good businesses, but they never made a profit. They just kept on doing what they're doing, and it never made a profit. Any profit they did make, they plowed into that idea or another idea. Spinners do tire easily, though. They get bored, and then they move on to the next idea. They tire easily of the nitty-gritty work to keep the idea or the endeavor going. They eventually get bored and they move on to a next idea. One month they're selling vitamins, the next month they're opening, you know, up a health club or whatever. They usually have a lot of failed websites and businesses behind their name because each one peters out because they take on another new idea. They just get bored. If a spinner doesn't hold a day job, he or she is usually in economic straits or in heavy debt. There are a lot of spinners, and it's one of the reasons, you know, new businesses have a high failure rate. Spinners are also responsible for many a failed marriage or friendship. As funds for each spin or to start each endeavor disappear down the rat hole of the spinner's latest failure. And I've known, you know, women who are married to men that just keep plowing the money into another idea and another idea and another idea. And I have known men that are married to women that have done the same thing. You know, and you've probably known people that are like that. Oh, my husband starts this idea and that idea and this idea. That's a spinner. Spinners usually operate alone, okay? But if there's two or three spinners together, usually problems result because when the endeavor fails, then the spinners point fingers at each other. In a comedic twist, because this whole thing is rather comedy-based, two fakers operating together can appear like a pair of spinners. I don't know if you You got to think about that one. In conclusion, there are many variations of each classification and different doses of each classification. You know, I myself, you know, have been a spinner on certain things, and I hope to think I've never been a faker or a weasel or a crook. You know, I'm an honest guy. You know, I have been a talker on occasion, you know, so, you know, some of these classifications work for me too. Keep in mind, these are my own classifications, and again, I'm not a psychologist or an expert in human behavior. It's just what I've seen. In 45 years, I've seen a lot of people in business. So I'd ask, what's your experience? Do any of these traits seem familiar in yourself or people that you know? Just so you know, if you're listening to this, earth movers won't ever hear this because they're too busy. Doers will probably love it. The dawdlers, fakers, and talkers will hate this newscast with a passion, as it pretty much nails them, and they will likely probably send me a bad email. Spinners will probably wonder if we're talking about them, and weasels are too delusional to make the connection. Slugs won't get it, because that's their ongoing problem on everything, and crooks just won't give a darn. So now you know who you are. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. I'll be right back. Band Warrant, pretty rotten, filthy, stinking rich. All right. Listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. And so I'm going to wrap up the show. Got a couple of minutes to talk about the markets here. Yeah, we saw this bump yesterday. Dow is now down 23. And the S&P down a little bit. And keep in mind, you know, the market, the stocks and mutual funds can move in concert with each other. You know, what's interesting is during the crisis, I saw a lot of portfolios, and most people own 4 or 5, 10, 12, 20 stocks to be diversified. And when I think of the word diversification, I picture a teeter-totter diversification to me means that if something goes down in your portfolio, then something should stay the same or go up. That's my definition of diversification. Now, other people's definition of diversification may be holding a wide basket of stocks or what have you, but I think everybody would agree that diversification means that you don't get hurt in one particular area. And so when I, during the crisis, I saw a lot of portfolios and I saw 10 or 20 stocks in every portfolio. And I saw literally hundreds of portfolios. People would talk to me, bring to me, send to me. And 99% during 08 and 09 were down. And so when you think of the word diversification, if I saw 20 stocks and I saw, you know, 200 portfolios, I saw 2,000 stocks, right? Or 4,000 stocks. And if owning a lot of stocks was diversified, how come during the crisis I saw almost all of them down? So one might ask the question, Mark, well, if holding a basket of stocks is not diversified from your experience during the crisis, what is diversified? Well, I think it's not a far stretch to say that holding some cash is diversified. And cash is a strategic position. Because if, you know, people would think that, well, holding cash is not an investment. Well, it can be. Because in a down market, if you hold cash or cash equivalent, let's say savings account or something like that, it doesn't drop in value. It may change in purchasing power, but the numbers don't change. So if you have $100,000 in a savings account or in cash, the number is not going to change. So while all the stock market might be hammered, your cash position wouldn't drop. And so if you just held cash and stocks, which is not what I'm telling you to do, but if, for example, only if you held cash and stocks, for somebody to hold all stocks, if the market gets hammered badly, the likelihood of his portfolio dropping is probably greater than it staying the same or rising. But if you hold cash and stocks, then that guy's not going to be hurt as bad in a falling market because the cash portion won't drop. So cash could be a diversification. Bonds, or what we call fixed income, could be a diversification. It's different than a stock. Maybe a rental or real estate might be diversification. Some people might think art or classic cars or precious metals might be a diversification. So when you think diversification, I always tell people, just don't think 50 stocks or 100 stocks. There are other asset classes, because if you're in all the stock market, there is something called market risk. And it's a bona fide risk assessment that we learn through all the advisor licensee classes, that market risk says no matter what stock you own, you are at general risk of most or all of them going down if the market goes down hard. So it's not my definition of market risk. It's an accepted definition of somebody that owns all stocks is at market risk of the whole market dropping. So the people that define these classifications have accepted this term of market risk. There's also things like political risk. Are the securities that you hold at risk of a political decision or a political event? Let's say you hold stocks in Venezuela and the political party comes in and confiscates all the businesses and makes them, socializes all the businesses. That's a political risk. So then there's regulatory risk. They could come in and say, okay, all stocks now have, 50% income tax. So there's different kinds of risks. Those are not all of them. Maybe we'll do a show on all the different types of accepted definitions of risk. So you have been listening to Money Matters. My name is Mark Cuniberti on your community radio station. I want to thank you for tuning in today. This is show number 248. Called Workers' Bees or Busybodies, named after the definition of workers that I read earlier. And I hope you enjoyed that. I think a lot of people saw that article and they said, well, that's a really good article. I would like to remind you that discussions on this show should definitely not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice in any way. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are opinions only, my opinions only, and the opinions of any authors of articles or interviews I may do. The opinions do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. My name's Mark. I want to thank you for listening. God bless. Stay tuned for more fine programming on your community radio station.